This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Many of us are working from home right now because of the coronavirus pandemic. For some, that could be a pleasant break from reality, time to get cozy but stay productive. For others who are already working from home, it's just more of the same. But for some Hoosiers, it means no work, no income. It can also mean a house full of kids, so productivity goes way down in some cases. So how are you dealing with it? Does the idea that this could go on for weeks or months make you anxious? Do you need more human contact than this allows? Can you feel yourself getting lonely or depressed? Today we're checking in, a little how you doing from the radio, and we want to hear from you. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, and you can leave us a voicemail as well. We'd love to hear your voice on this one if you want to share. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick message about your situation or your concerns about the pandemic, your work life, or your mental health. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Here to help via Skype are two Indianapolis area licensed psychologists, Dr. Julie Steck. Good afternoon.
Hello there.
And Dr. Sandra Burkhardt. Hello.
Hello.
And if you have questions about the virus or other physical health related questions, we have Shandy Dirth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health. Hi, Shandy.
Hello.
And Dr. Graham Carlos, he's Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health in Indianapolis. Welcome to you.
Hello, everyone.
Dr. Steck, before we get to our listener concerns, I'll just share what's been on my mind since this started. And that's my concern for people whose industries are taking a big financial hit, which is, in a way, just about everybody. But what comes to mind immediately are restaurants and storefront retail. I mean, if nobody's out, nobody's buying, anxiety is probably through the roof for the owners and employees of those businesses. What's something those people can do to keep the worry from completely taking over?
That's a great question. And I think really you're referring to people who are in the service industries, the people who meet our needs day in and day out in restaurants and the places you named. I think, first of all, I think they need to make sure they're connecting with others and connecting with people who not only share their concerns, but who can be provide some support in a positive way. It's easy to connect with other people who are in a negative place. So trying to connect with people who can be more positive. The other thing I would look at is there are some areas that are clamoring for people to work. We've talked yesterday, Dr. Burkhardt and I talked about the fact that Amazon's hiring. I tried to get online store delivery today and it couldn't be done till next Tuesday. So clearly there are some areas hiring. I don't want to be naive and think it's easy to get those jobs, but taking action usually makes people feel more in power, more in control.
Dr. Burkhardt, would the anxiety of a career change be too much for some people to bear right now?
Well, I think anytime unexpected things occur, we have to give ourselves a little bit of time for adjustment. And while you might be motivated to want to make quick changes or to try to grasp control over those things that you might be able to control, we do have to allow for that adjustment period, which does not mean that we're failing to keep up our routines or healthy things, but that we're also taking a pause to make sure that we're doing an honest assessment of our resources for doing it. So, yeah, brushing off the resume, networking with people who might have some ideas about jobs, any kind of positive action, I think, is great. I would caution against, though, people putting all their eggs in that basket of figuring, like, I absolutely have to do this right now, because we do have to allow for this adjustment period, which is going to go on for a little while.
Dr. Burkhardt, I have a friend who has a daughter with autism, and she has a real need for structure and social interaction, and this has been particularly hard on her. And my friend, her dad, is doing everything that he can to connect her with her teachers and her friends online. Isolation can be hard on anybody, but what is this going to be like for someone like her?
Well, that's a wonderful question, obviously in an area that I've worked a lot with. And I'm going to use this opportunity to some of the youngsters and young people who may be listening. I want to welcome you to tuning into this type of thing. And if you have questions about what you hear or it concerns you, make sure that you check with your parents so that you understand some of the reassuring things that we're saying, even as you hear some very concerning things. To your question, Matt, I think that parents of any children with special needs, even mild special needs, have to understand that this adjustment period is going to be very overwhelming. Clearly, there's no way to put in place the immediate kinds of supports that kids had when they were in school, maybe interacting with their clinical specialists and special ed teachers. So what we want to do is set realistic expectations. Number one, try to keep the routine as possible. Reaching out on social media and those types of things is important. Many individuals need some downtime, and so kind of mixing in breaks, sensory breaks, whatever we want to call it, in between some of the e-learning activities or other things, I think parents can go a long way to setting up a new normal type of schedule for their child that is a balance between structure but also the flexibility necessary for us all to kind of get a deep breath and cope.
Dr. Steck, this is an area of expertise for you as well. Would you have anything to add on that scenario?
Well, I think one thing I would encourage parents to do in this week and probably next is to recognize that schools are, and particularly public schools, if children have IEPs, are really kind of trying to figure out what they're going to do. And some districts were better equipped to handle distance learning or e-learning than others. But I would say I'd give them a week or two. And then if you're not hearing from your school, particularly if your child has an IEP, I would email them and ask for guidance in how you can support the young person at home. You know, we recognize everyone's going to have an adjustment in this first week or two. I mean, even our office, we're trying to do most everything through teleconferencing and phones, but even the internet's slow right now. So give schools a week or two, but I think it's very appropriate to then email the teacher of record, or the special ed director and say, please give us guidance on how we're to go forward.
We're talking with two psychologists, an epidemiologist and an MD about concerns about isolation from the coronavirus and also the virus's spread. Any concerns you might have, this is a listener check-in today, and you can reach us on social media via Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. We would love to hear how you're handling this and your unique scenario. Shandy Dearth, I knew that it wouldn't take long, but I'm beginning to see economic anxieties around this pandemic sort of manifest into cynicism among some people. It's so easy to go online and pop off, but what would you say to people who are beginning to think maybe we're blowing this out of proportion?
I would encourage you to think about your parents and your grandparents. Those are the populations we're really trying to protect right now. And I've heard a lot of that feedback that, you know, what about H1N1 in 2009? We didn't take all of those actions that we're taking now. And there are lots of points I can offer about that. But a big one is that we see flu on a regular basis. We know how flu works a little bit more. But this coronavirus, it's new. We've had some time to see what happened in China and Italy and Spain, and we need to learn from those lessons. So I don't think we're overreacting. I don't think this is blown out of proportion. And we're not asking anyone to change their lives permanently. This is going to be a few weeks to a few months of change, and then we can go back to what our normal used to be.
Dr. Carlos, to illustrate to people what this does and why it's not like the flu, what would you say about the coronavirus and how people are affected?
Sure, thanks. So one way that it's different is it appears to have a longer on-ramp before you really start to develop symptoms. And that's important because in the days leading up to your symptoms, That would be the day from when you were first exposed to the day when you first start with, let's say, a cough. You might be shedding, which is a word that means you are exposing people around you in your environment to the virus. That's important because people may go out and go about their business as they normally would, not knowing that they're putting other people at risk, particularly elderly folks and folks who have health conditions that we're seeing from China and Italy and elsewhere are at higher risk for developing severe complications from this coronavirus. The main complications we're seeing are effects on the lungs and the heart.
And I think what we have seen lately are that more younger people are being affected than maybe some people are. I guess some of the information out there, what I'm trying to say is that it only affects older people, but this is happening to younger populations as well.
That's right, and that's an important consideration because younger people typically have very strong immune systems, and so they mount a very strong immune response to infection. That's typically a good thing. But when the immune response creates lots of inflammation in the lungs, it can block the transfer of oxygen from the air we breathe into our blood to get oxygen to our organs. This becomes a big problem for the healthcare system because if you have many people who develop the virus and then inflammation in their lungs, we're going to have a strain on healthcare in terms of resources because the only way that you can improve that we know of right now is supportive care with extra oxygen. And that is sometimes involving oxygen delivered through the use of ventilators, special machines that hospitals have that are equipped to deliver higher concentrations of oxygen and literally push the air into the lungs to kind of push it past the inflammation and get it into the body.
This hour, we are checking in with you, the listener. How are you handling this big change? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We have a panel of experts with us to answer your questions and address your concerns about mental health, physical health, and the spread of the coronavirus in Indiana. We are on the line, of course, with Dr. Graham Carlos, clinical psychologist Dr. Steck, and Dr. Burkhart. Shandy Dearth is an epidemiologist, and we will be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today's show is about you, how you're dealing with social isolation, kids at home, work, and therefore income coming to a halt for some of us. And we want to hear how it's going. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also send us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, to 866-476-3881. We're joined by two Indianapolis area licensed psychologists, Dr. Julie Steck and Dr. Sandra Burkhart. We also have Shandy Dearth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health, and Dr. Graham Carlos, Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health in Indianapolis. We have a voicemail from a listener in Lafayette who has a concern about physicians. Let's listen to that now.
My concern is about physicians who are working but canceling their patients' appointments, and they have to report to the hospital, and they are making any money of our physicians, especially in the IU health system and other San Elizabeth system, are on RVU, which is productivity. So when they cancel patients, they are not making any productivity, and they are still available to work, and they are the first line of treating this pan-epidemic. So that's the only concern. Thank you.
Dr. Carlos, it seems like the listener's concern is that the economic impact could also hit the healthcare industry, although I don't know that too many people are thinking about that right now.
Yes, that's possible, particularly for certain types of physicians who are reliant on outpatient practice. This cancellation of surgeries coupled with clinics moving towards telehealth or virtual health may have some effects downstream on individual practitioners. I know to counter that, we're trying to become very creative with looking for other ways to use our physician resources. We know that physicians can provide help via telehealth or virtual health and do so in some cases from the comfort of their own homes. Again, getting at social distancing and trying to keep ourselves away to prevent spread of the virus. Further, in hospitals and in clinics around the city and the state, we're finding that as we get more cases of the virus in, it's helpful to have physicians sometimes working in new roles. An example of that might be in intensive care where I work, we're finding with the visitor restrictions have made it difficult for us to keep up the same lines of communication with our families as we normally would. So we're actively looking into asking our physician colleagues to help us be communicators to the families, calling them, giving them updates, participating in care of the patient in new and creative ways. So I expect as this pandemic continues to spread that we will continue to lean on all of our physicians, providers, to help us in new and novel ways. And I'm thankful for everybody that's already volunteered and stepped up to rise to that challenge and learn and help us do something new.
We have a listener voicemail from Abby in Indianapolis with one of her concerns. Let's listen.
I think what we should do is everybody should choose a place to support, like a business, small business, restaurant, and just if you have a job, you still got income, hit them hard. Just favorite restaurant every week, you know, have a full dinner, takeout. But that's going to be one of the saddest things, I think, is if we have all these businesses and restaurants begin to close. So everybody support those. Thanks. Bye.
Abby, I got to say, I'm with you. My wife and I have talked about the same thing. We've said, let's get takeout every night until this is all over with. But Shandy Dearth, is there a risk with that?
So, you know, the public health side of me says eat as healthy as you can on a regular basis. But in reality, I've got some of my favorite restaurants that I plan to hit up more often than usual, just because I am also trying to support some of those local businesses. And using the food delivery services, the carryout options, that's fine. We have had some questions about, you know, can I go into a place and have a drink while I wait for my food? No, the restaurant should not be serving any food to be eaten or any drinks to be consumed while you're at the establishment. The goal is to get in and get out as quick as possible, touch as few items as possible so you're not contaminating anything, you're not picking up any contamination, but using these sorts of options are definitely okay.
We have a Facebook comment from Carol in South Bend who says, personally, I wasn't prepared for how much I would miss my grandchildren. My nearly 95-year-old mother is in an assisted living facility that isn't allowing any visitors. She's in hospice care. It's very difficult not to be able to see her. Dr. Sandra Burkhart, this is something that is surely happening all over.
Yes, I think that the emotional side of this, psychologists a lot of times like to talk about emotion-focused coping and problem-focused coping. And I think takeout from your local restaurant and those things really get at the idea of problem-focused coping. When your mom is in hospice and you can't visit and you're passing food on the porch from your grandchildren and little cards and you're leaving them goodies in return, these are the heartbreaking emotion-focused coping that we're talking about right now. Mental health care professionals, of course, we worry about this, not only for people who may have anxiety and depression and other kinds of diagnosed disorders, but for every single person who's experiencing a change in the kind of social and emotional support that they get. I think that we have to mourn it and we have to acknowledge and validate that it really is tough not to be able to keep up your social contacts, those important relationships. I also think that in addition to that, though, that we can remind ourselves that this will pass, that this is a short period of time, that if we look back on our regular schedules, sometimes there may have been a week or two maybe when we didn't get together or didn't get to see people, only talked with them on social media or whatever, and try to remind ourselves that this will come to, it will wind up at some time, and that we'll be able to resume some of our normal social interactions. In the meantime, finding something positive to do, Many of us, a lot of times, are so busy that we don't read, we don't watch old movies or whatever else it is. That can also sometimes kind of touch at those same sort of emotional connections that we might need, and at the same time be able to, not be the same as interacting with the grandkids, but certainly give us a chance to acknowledge our emotional needs and maybe cheer ourselves up sometimes.
Dr. Carlos, I can't imagine what things are like in the healthcare world right now. I mean, we hear things like what's happened in northern Italy, and we're doing what we can to prevent this kind of that kind of a catastrophe from happening here. But what's the tone there at the front lines of this crisis?
It's mixed. I believe that all of us have gone through the gamut of different emotions in the last several days. Fear, anxiety. We've also seen incredible togetherness and oneness as providers band together to rise to this challenge and attempt to overcome it. I've seen people working together in new and creative ways like never before. As I walk through the hallways of the hospital, we're getting more smiles, more how you doing. The teams are coming together in order to function together as a team in a way like we've never had to before. So my answer to you would be mixed, that we all are in it together, and I think that's a mentality we've kind of embraced. At the same time, we're busy, so we're not in isolation, left alone with our thoughts. We have so many jobs to do and tasks to complete in order to prepare the hospitals. So many of us have been extremely busy, which takes your mind off of things to a certain extent, too, I suppose.
We are checking in with you, the listener, and seeing how you're handling social isolation, social distancing with regard to the coronavirus pandemic. We're on the line with Dr. Julie Steck, Dr. Sandra Burkhart, both psychologists. Dr. Graham Carlos is an MD, and we also have Shandy Dirth, an epidemiologist, on the line with us. And we want to hear from you. You can call us at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Or hit us up on our social media, Facebook or Twitter, at All in Indiana. We have another listener voicemail from Charlotte in Indianapolis. Let's listen to that now.
I am a pastor of a congregation with a lot of older adults. I also have a mother who is in assisted living. And I'm really concerned about the effects of isolation for our loved ones. For 2 weeks, they have already been quarantined, and now in most facilities, they are needing to eat their meals in their rooms. My mother was depressed after 5 days, and she's not even prone to depression. Just really concerned about that, wondering about the effects, and what reasonably can we do to help mitigate it? Thank you.
Dr. Julie Steck, what are these people going through, and how can we help without actually going there?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm going to answer from my perspective. Then I'd like to hear from one of the medically oriented people. But certainly, I think phone calls are something we can do, sending letters. I know Dr. Burkhart yesterday said that her granddaughter was sending letters and cards to nursing homes. So I think all of us can reach out, whether we have a loved one there or not. I guess what I'd like to know, if I may ask a question, is there a time when they're being isolated can be let up a little bit so that they can start to have some activities within their facility? I know letting people in from the outside is a ways off, but I know when I've had relatives in nursing homes, a lot of times it was the interaction with their caregivers there that brought them great joy.
Shandy Dirth, is there any risk in that kind of interaction in a population like that?
So the concern here is that when you bring a group of vulnerable people together, as we've heard, you could be asymptomatic but still be shedding the virus. So you could potentially have a healthcare worker, someone working in the long-term care facility, be ill and not know it yet. And the more you bring these patients together in like a common sitting area, like a dining hall, you're just increasing the risk of spread among that group, the group that's going to be hit the hardest with this. And so I understand there's a huge implication here with isolation on the mental side, but this isolation will also help protect the physical side.
What would, I mean, how bad, I guess, could it get, Shandy, if COVID-19 were to spread through a place like an assisted living facility?
So we have seen it spread through a long-term care facility in Seattle, and that's where a number of deaths have come from in Washington. So that's why the public health recommendations are so strict about distancing the patients from one another and separating people so that they're not too close together in the dining areas.
We have a listener voicemail from David in Plainfield who has a couple of comments. Let's listen.
I just wanted to say, I work for FedEx Ground, so I'm not stuck at home, but we are taking extra precautions in this trying time. We now have permission that we get to sign the scanner and punch in your name. You don't have to touch our scanner at all. My wife works at a fast food restaurant where they are reducing hours and closing lobbies, but they're trying to balance the schedule, so don't be afraid to go get your stuff. Just realize that the drive-through times are going to take longer, but stuff's still going on. I just wanted to say, don't panic. There's still plenty of stuff to go around. We're delivering all the stuff you guys order. So sit tight, be good, and hopefully you can weather the storm as well as possible.
Shandy Dearth, when you hear something like that, I understand when we hear don't panic that there is, you know, there are good intentions behind that. But do you think that there is also complacency that could result from that?
Well, I think it's important to say don't panic. I agree with that 100%. Now is the time to plan, not panic. So panic never does anyone any good in any situation. I think the gentleman's comment about, you know, things are being delivered. I think that's important to know. I know I'm one of those people out there looking for some grocery items I just haven't been able to find these last couple of weeks just because I think people kind of panicked. But we can get through this. We can all work together. We can remain calm. But you should take it seriously without being too complacent with it.
Dr. Sandra Burkhart, if people are at home and they don't see the light at the end of the tunnel for this, and indeed we don't know when this will be over with, what kind of mental illnesses could be exacerbated by that level of uncertainty?
Well, again, you're trying to stay in a positive note with things. People who have been dealing with mental illnesses, either mild or more severe, many of them do have access, they continue to have access to the professionals that help them get through that. We are offering telepsychology, there's telemedicine, certainly psychiatrists and people who are in the know in this specialization are making arrangements to make sure that their patients continue to have an adequate level of care, and that's very important. I think the discomfort that people who don't have diagnosed disorders or maybe have had them under control for a long period of time, they may be experiencing an incredible increase in symptoms and really sort of panicking about not necessarily the circumstances, but the way they're feeling. Their sleep is being disturbed. They're waking up with a knot in the pit of their stomach. They're fretting over what might happen to their children or their parents or themselves. And so I think that kind of worry that can seize people can lead, if we don't interrupt that cycle, if we don't take a break from that, shut off the source of the recurring breaking news, if we don't give ourselves a little break from that, we do put ourselves at risk of a kind of mental fatigue, a mental exhaustion that could actually lead to the symptoms kind of taking on a life of their own and we can't control it anymore. So an ounce of prevention is really worth a pound of treatment at that point, and that is exercising, going out and having activities, meditating, doing some of the things that maybe ordinarily we'd poo-poo and say, well, I don't have time for that. Now is really a good time to do that because it's preventative. I also want to add that about the social distancing, because it's hard for all of us to do this. But my husband made an interesting comment this morning. He said people who say, well, I just want to see so-and-so, I just want to see so-and-so, that's the equivalent of washing one hand and saying, well, I did my part to avoid the spread of this. So we need to wash both hands in terms of social distancing as well, and find other calming ways to reduce our anxiety and still stay in contact with other people.
Shandy Dirth, there are people who are still visiting others, maybe on a limited basis. If they're coming into town, do we call them off under all circumstances?
I'm advising that you do. I'm telling everyone, try and delay that meeting. Again, this is not permanent. It's for a few weeks or a couple of months. So I would much rather have the opportunity to see that person many times for many years to come than me potentially contaminate someone and pass on a virus that I don't know I have yet. So I myself canceled my trip to visit my dad with my kids this week during spring break, because I'd like them to have many years with my dad and not just, you know, this one other trip. And to be honest, I can't guarantee my kids haven't picked up something from somewhere else.
We're going to have to leave it at that. We'll be back in just a minute. We have more listener concerns to go through when we get back, including yours. Share them on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back now talking with you about how you're handling the coronavirus crisis professionally and personally. We're on the line with two Indianapolis area psychologists, an epidemiologist, and an MD. And we're taking your questions and comments on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Brittany from Indianapolis writes, I work at a residential rehab for women, particularly mothers who are pregnant or recently postpartum with substance use disorders. You can imagine the distress and confusion on how to deal with social distancing and universal precautions when you're working with such a high risk population with their babies in the facility with us. We are all scared. You can shut it down, but send these mothers. You can't shut it down and send these mothers out to face relapse, homelessness, and COVID-19. But what else can we do? Dr. Steck, as Brittany mentions, some of us have even bigger problems to begin with. Can a crisis like this put vulnerable populations at an even greater risk?
Well, absolutely. And I think, first of all, I want to thank all of the people who are doing that kind of work day in and day out. It is hard without the stresses we have right now. I think one of the problems that I'm guessing that the center is facing is what are they supposed to do from a systematic, or what is the state or whoever the funding source is telling them to do? And that's probably putting a level of stress on the people who work there as well as the clients in terms of what comes next. And I think that's a stress we all have right now. And I'm not minimizing that their stress isn't worse, but we're waiting to see what the systems of care and financial support around us are going to provide. I would say the obvious, I know it's obvious, but those who provide care for others need to make sure they take care of themselves. And I don't know if, I think Brittany was her name, is supposed to be doing isolation from her friends and family because she's been exposed, but my guess is she's being very cautious. But again, I think I can't see enough for trying to surround yourself, whether it's virtually through FaceTime or emails or phone calls, with people who can be supportive of you if you're a caregiver. Because if you're not at risk from a health perspective, you will make it through this, but you want to have positive supports around you. Obviously, caregivers should try to get outside and exercise, move about. And if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of those mothers and their babies. So I think a lot of right now what we're waiting for is to find out how the systems will support those in programs and those who are providing the care, but take care of yourself.
We have another listener voicemail, this one from TA in Indianapolis, with a question about elbow bumping. Let's listen.
Could you please have your guest discuss the problem about elbow bumping and also coughing into the elbow at a later time, in which you have an infected person coughing into their elbow, then elbow bumping with someone who's not infected and transferring the virus in that way, so that when the second person coughs into their elbow, their nose and their mouth come in contact with contaminated fabric? Thank you very much.
Shandy Dearth, guilty as charged. I do my best to cough into my elbow, but in lieu of a handshake anymore, really, lately I've been doing nothing. But before that, I was bumping elbows. Problematic?
Well, I've got to say, I was doing the same thing. We kind of pushed the elbow move at first to get people away from the handshake. But I think what I'm seeing is a lot of people aren't even doing the elbow bumping anymore, exactly because of the reason that the gentleman gave, is that there is concern. There's not a lot of data out there to show that elbow bumping itself transmits a lot. Your hand really holds in a lot of contamination. That's why we definitely don't want any handshaking. And maybe Dr. Carlos can give some more background information on the elbow bumping, but we do think there's less risk than handshaking with that.
Dr. Carlos, do we know anything about that?
Well, for starters, elbow bumping completely gets away from social distancing. So to bump elbows, you got to be pretty close to one another. And if you're within elbow range, you're within coughing and sneezing range as well. Yes, if you were to observe me going through the hospital where everybody knows how this stuff works, nobody's elbow bumping. People are keeping appropriate distance from each other. Even as you get on the elevator, people are going to all four corners. We're doing everything we can to stay away from each other to contain the virus as much as possible.
Judy sent us this comment on Facebook. I just spoke with my daughter-in-law in North Carolina. She doesn't believe this is bad. I know that younger people have a sense of immortality, the it can't happen to me or my family kind of mentality. How do you talk to them and convince them to stay home? Shandy Dearth?
So that's an issue we come up against with every public health problem, unfortunately. We're all invincible when we're younger, right? So what I would encourage people to do is, again, think about their parents, think about the grandparents in their lives, and understand that, yes, this young person, if they get it, they will probably be fine. They might not even be symptomatic. But the problem is they can be a spreader and they can share it with a loved one. And it truly is a problem. And if they would pay attention to some of the real news sources out there showing some of the devastation the other countries have seen, they should understand that the U.S. is not invincible from this. We can be facing that as well.
Let's hear from another listener. Andy from Facebook writes that he's a subcontractor in the AV production industry, and he came home after a recent convention to tons of cancellations. He says, the worst part is that we're a non-essential industry, so the upcoming summer is my busy season. I make a majority of my income for the slow, late winter months. So are we going to have concerts and meetings in the coming months, or should I get a job unloading trucks at the local grocery store? Dr. Steck, I imagine this kind of an uncertainty is being shared in a lot of industries that depend on social interaction. What's something Andy can do to quell his anxiety?
Well, I think a couple of things. One, I kind of said this earlier. One is surround yourself with people who can be supportive. Two,
virtually, of course.
Virtually, yes. I'm sorry, virtually. And by the way, if you haven't figured it out, Dr. Burkhardt and I are in that vulnerable age group, over 60. I won't go farther than that. but I am finding that virtual contact by FaceTime, or right now we're on Skype talking with you, or texting or phones, while I wouldn't have thought this a few years ago, I'm finding it's filling a void. So one, if Andy could surround himself with positive people virtually, I think do what he can now to move forward. But in an industry like he is, I think I would say, what are the opportunities that might be available as our culture shifts? I'm pretty convinced we're going to see some major shifts in our culture after COVID-19. And ask yourself, what might those shifts be, and where can I find a niche and get ahead of I hate to say get ahead of. We don't want to, you know, we don't want to trounce on people. But how can I position myself for what's going to come after this pandemic? Because there will be shifts and there will be opportunities. That would be, I'm an optimist. That would be my way of thinking.
Dr. Sandra Burkhart, we hear often, particularly before this crisis hit us, about the negatives of social media. And now that it's one of the only ways we can communicate and find a sense of community without actually being around each other, do you think that social media is a blessing in this situation?
Absolutely. Again, as you mentioned before, I'm fairly familiar with dealing with persons with autism spectrum disorder, many of whom have been masterful and are very, very self-contained and happy being on social media, being on games and things like that. So a long time ago, I had to sort of weigh the costs and benefits of that particular way of people spending their time and engaging other people. And virtual friends are real friends. Virtual friends are real friends. These are people who you get to know and care about and can communicate with, and they'll get back to you, and maybe you can find things that are shared interests. And so even though it is an adjustment, there's no doubt that people often enjoy our gala events and all those gatherings. I can't emphasize enough that virtual friends are real friends. These are really people that you can connect with and share emojis and all those things with. And as Dr. Steck mentioned, it does satisfy a certain need because human beings crave that. And to tell you the truth, we had to get used to doing it by telephone. My grandmother used to say, it's not a real visit. If you call me, you have to come here in person. And so I think as we adjust to the new realities of the 21st century, this is definitely a way for us to stay connected to people.
I'm hitting the like button on that, Dr. Burkhart. We have a new listener voicemail from Katarina in Indianapolis about Hoosiers supporting each other. Let's listen to that now.
I just wanted to say that I really am thankful for all of the support. Everyone is really banding together right now, especially for our service industry friends. I'm not in the service industry anymore, but I only recently got out a month ago, and I'm seeing a bunch of volunteers and websites and donation sites go up, and it really warms my heart that Hoosiers are sticking together right now because your service workers need that. Don't go in, but buy a gift card. Tell your friends to buy a gift card, anything we can do right now because these people need it. My friends need it. Family needs it. Your family and friends need it. And, yeah, don't panic. We're going to get through this. Thank you.
Dr. Julie Steck, it's a nice sentiment. And everyone who can do something should think about doing something. And I don't know. Do you have a comment on what Katarina had to say?
I think there is going to be a lot positive that can come out of this. And I think people helping people is a huge positive. So I totally agree with you, Katarina. I have a brother in the restaurant business and I was there yesterday. I just stopped by because he was closing it down. I'm very concerned about all those people, but I think they will band together and we can band around them. There was a wonderful interview with Kevin Love, who's a basketball player who has the coronavirus right now. Last night, I saw it on TV talking about the importance of us all supporting each other. And I was touched by his message, and I couldn't agree more. We can get through this. People got through World War II. They got through the virus of 1918. We will get through this, but we have to come through it a better people, showing more support for each other. And I think we're going to see some changes in value systems for the positive. So that's my message for what it's worth.
Katie sent us this comment on Facebook. Please note, in my friend group, it is us who are trying to get through to our older parents to convince them that they need to stay home. Please talk to older adults, many who have serious health conditions, to take this seriously. Shandy Dirth, that sounds like one for you. Is this message being lost among some people?
It is. I've had that struggle myself with my own dad, who I mentioned earlier. And so what I'm really stressing is the fact that that data coming out of China is showing us that people in the age group of 80 plus, they've got over a 14% fatality rate with this. So it's significant. They really need to protect themselves. Again, this is not forever. It's for a short time, and they can do that so that we can see them again in a few months and a few years.
I wanted to make sure I got to this one. Paula from Indianapolis writes, the things that never crossed my mind affecting others until this pandemic, AA and NA meetings, group therapy meetings, and support groups. Dr. Burkhardt, I hadn't thought of that either. There's so much to think about. What about those people who, left on their own, could face some serious mental health challenges?
It's a very interesting question, and one that I don't specifically know the answer as to what AA and the other 12-step programs are recommending at this time. My guess would be that, again, virtual meetings would be possible. It will not give the same level of support, perhaps. But again, I think that all of us are going to have to rethink the way we have done things, even the most valuable things we've done. But I will send out that message as in any other day for a person in recovery, one day at a time. And today is the day that you can continue to pursue your positive path. So even though we don't, almost everybody has a sponsor, sponsors often communicate by phone or other ways. It's not just meetings. So please use those resources. But remember, especially at crisis times like this, maintaining your sobriety is your number one priority.
Laura sent us this comment on Twitter. Please, please, please encourage Hoosiers to limit how many of their family members go to the store. This is not the time to have your children playing in the aisles. And Shandy Dirth, I'll follow that up, and I'll follow up Paula's comment as well from an epidemiologist perspective. Is there a safe way around those kinds of meetings, AA and things like that? It's easy to cancel a meeting for some social club, but for somebody who could relapse without the official social validation that something like AA provides, could meetings like those be excused as long as there are appropriate precautions being taken?
I mean, again, I would really stress the importance of keeping the group smaller than 10 if possible and doing some of that social distancing. So maybe the sponsors need to offer meetings more often so that you're spreading out the people over multiple appointments throughout the day or multiple group sessions. And again, making sure things are sanitized on a regular basis, such as doorknobs, bathroom, hand sinks, all sorts of things like that. Because I realize we don't want to have anyone relapse because of the isolation. Sometimes they need to reach out. But again, I would really emphasize the need to try and look for virtual meeting options whenever possible.
Chris from Nashville writes, September 19th, I was laid off from my primary career. At that time, I began full-time developing scientific research robots. Interesting. I was slated to appear on a television program at the end of March. Everything got canceled, so I'm anxious and concerned as a business owner, not to mention someone who suffers from extreme food and other allergies. There's a lot to unpack there from Chris in Nashville. Let's see, Dr. Burkhardt, just sounds like there are a lot of variables there to consider, and we've only got about 15 seconds.
Okay. Well, again, I think setting priorities, making sure that you're maintaining a positive attitude during a period of adjustment. There's going to be disappointments when things get canceled and those things. But again, rescheduling, getting skills in order, kind of preparing for what you anticipate doing in the future might be a good use of time right now.
I want to thank you all for your time today. Psychologist Dr. Julie Steck, we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Sandra Burkhardt, thank you.
Thank you.
Shandy Dirth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IU Fairbanks School of Public Health, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Graham Carlos is Chief of Internal Medicine at Eskenazi Health in Indianapolis. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Stay safe, Indy.
Tomorrow, we are going to recap Indiana's 2020 legislative session that wrapped up a week ago. In the meantime, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana.